Sir Andrew Holsbrook Porter, Reel 5. Sir Andrew, you mentioned Lanchesters taking over from the 11th Hussars, that you had Lanchester armoured cars. Did you have any special training for those?
No. No, I just took them away. Well, we went to the Tsar with them. Stepped in and drove them. They're all right. Big, heavy cars.
How do they compare with the Rolls Royce?
Oh, well, I think they're a better... probably they might have been a better armoured fighting vehicle, but I think they weren't. There were tricks in between. They were too high. I wouldn't have liked to fought them. We didn't in the end. We just had them for a short time. So that's all I can tell you about the Lanchester. Didn't think much of it. It didn't see daylight in the war, I don't think. I suppose we flogged them to some Arab state in those days where we didn't have to sell them for oil. I don't know.
You took them to the Tsar. Were they effective for what you were doing there?
Well, any armour car, yes. But we weren't fighting or anything. We were just patrolling around. They seemed to be fairly reliable cars. We patrolled around in the Tsar. And they worked all right. Well, we hadn't been trained in them. Now, the troops hadn't been trained in them, but the troops, as I say, were pretty efficient. And then, do you want me to talk about the Tsar? The Tsar was, as you know, the Germans had just marched into the Rhineland without any opposition from the politicians. And when we travelled across France, we stayed with various regiments. We stayed at Reims, the last stage, with I think it was the 8th Dragoons. And they were shaking their heads a great deal about both our and their politicians not taking a stronger stand over that takeover. And when we got into the Tsar, we were keeping order. For the plebiscite, there was a British brigadier in overall command and about 1,500 Italians, infantry and light tanks, and I think a Swedish force. It was some neutral force. When I say neutral, some Scandinavian force. It might have been Swedes, it might have been Norwegians. And just this one swung around the cars. And what we did is we patrolled round the place to see that nobody mauled anybody else about. But of course it's quite obvious with the signs and everything else that the plebiscite was a foregone conclusion with these young Nazis marching about the place with placards and frightening the French feeling people, and especially the Jews, frightening them into fits. And the first time I realized how close we were to trouble with Germany. It's the first time I'd been on the continent, except for my honeymoon, and it did give you a bit of a cold feeling. Then it was 35, wasn't it? Winter 35. And the plebiscite took place, and we went home. We were there 3 months. And I took a great dislike to the Nazis. And I was billeted with some unfortunate Jews, decent Jews who lived there all their lives, and they vanished just before the plebiscite. They hopped it, and I suppose that is the beginning of this exodus of unfortunate Jews. Yeah, it was unpleasant altogether. I'm very glad to get home and get on with training. And it's about that time that Dick McCrary, the Dick McCreary took command, did he? Yes, I suppose Dick McCreary was commanding then. And I went to Eden for a year, which is a very pleasant interlude. And we then, 36, the regiment had gone out on a scare. It rushed out to Egypt on a scare about Mussolini, and they sat about doing very little as part of the mobile division, and then came home again. I didn't go there because I was either at Wheaton or looking after the details left at Tidworth. And so Dick McCreary was training us, and he came back in time. He came back from Egypt just in time. I'd been running the polo ponies, and he came back just in time to win the interregimental tournament, which was a big thing in those days, polo tournament. It was a great triumph for him as commanding officer. And then he left his period of command. He didn't do his full time because he was asked to go as GSO1 to Major General Alexander, who was commanding the 1st Division, which is the crack division. And Dick went as his G1. And then Herbert Lumsden, who was to be one of our greatest men, took over command in 38, I should think. Then we moved to Aldershot from Tidworth. And we were, Aldershot for a year, weren't we, before the war. And Herbert was a great man. And so was Dick. Two very great men. Actually, all the commanding officers of the 12th Lancers, they were all very great men, but I'm not sure that the best regimental soldier, wasn't old Paul Hornby, who never went any further. But he was a very fine disciplinarian, very fair, very knowledgeable, and very much respected. Not that the others weren't. That Dick and Herbert were more brilliant. But I think that a great deal of the good training which Herbert had the advantage of in the war did stem a great deal from old Paul Hornby's thorough putting his nose into every tiny administrative corner in the regiment.
He was commanding while you were out in the desert, wasn't he?
Yeah. Good man. Very good man.
That training that you just mentioned there, would you say that comprised also the sort of mechanised training you had?
Yes.
He was competent in that as well.
Well, he didn't know anything about it when he wasn't there competent himself, but he saw that everybody else worked. What I've said just now, I mean, Dick McCreary took over absolutely sound, brilliantly, highly class, highly trained regiment. And Dick put the polish on it. He was a brilliant man himself. And Dick was responsible for, I think, these signal exercises. He realized that signals were going to be our signals. Radio communication was to be our lifeblood. Dick realized that. And Dick made soldiering fun, too. It was the morale. I've never seen anything like the morale of the regiment under any of them. And then when Herbert came, Herbert, in point of fact, relaxed. We'd been very hardly trained. We'd been very hard worked by old Paul, worked us like hell. Dick worked us hard. And Herbert was a very shrewd man, and he rather relaxed. He reckoned that we were pretty well trained. And he rather relaxed in the 38 to 39, before he took us to war. And then Herbert in war was the best thing that's ever been seen. He's the best regimental commander, best brigade commander, and divisional and corps commander that's ever been seen in the Royal Armoured Corps. But he'd fallen foul of Monty in a way I could explain, but I'm not going to. They're both dead. And we couldn't have had better commanders. Right.
One thing before we go on. You mentioned you'd gone to Weedon.
Oh, yeah.
Why was that in view of the fact that you'd become mechanised? Why did you go to a cavalry?
Well, Weedon... well, I tell you what had happened there, was that when we were first mechanised, there were two vacancies at Weedon, which had been arranged for the 11th Hussars and 12th Lancers. And Ian Smith, who was a very splendid 12th Lancer, and much older senior to me, Ian Smith was just going to Weedon when this mechanisation took place. And Bertie Bingley, the 11th Hussars, was going too. Well, he went to Weedon, and Colonel Charrington said to Ian Smith, you must go to Bovingdon instead, which was frightful hard luck of poor old Ian. The Inspector General Cavalry at the time was Mike Houston, who had been knew the regiment, and he was looking through his file, and he said, oh, the 12th Lancers sacrificed a course at Weedon in 1929. They're all well trained. Offer it again to the 12 Lancers. So I benefited. Well, poor old Ian had been rather done down, I reckon.
Wasn't it rather peculiar going back to horses and things if you were working in...
No, I don't think so. I think it's very good training for anything to do with a horse. It's very good training for anything to do with hunting and polo is extremely good training for quick thinking and decision. It's quite a dangerous sport. Skiing is a very damn good exercise. But you want to exercise yourself apart from just theory. And danger, slight danger, quick thinking, especially polo, does smarten you up as a soldier. Certainly.
Would this be typical then a fact of the two regiments who were mechanised, that they still sent people to Weedon on courses like that?
Well, they only sent one. As I say, Bertie Bingley went before they'd started. And to even things up, I went. I was fairly well trained. There wasn't nothing much else I could do but train my mechanisation.
When you were
and I got a D at Weedon. That's the only D I ever got.
That's not so good, is it?
They're distinguished.
Oh, sorry.
Yes, that's the best. There are very few Ds. Q1 I got as a gutter, as a driver, and everything else. But a D at Weedon was all right.
When you got to Tidworth and things, you've mentioned that you did wireless exercises.
Yeah.
What other kind of things were you doing?
Oh, Lord, we're doing a lot of night ops and that sort of thing, night exercises. And we used to cooperate with the Cavalry Brigade, raid them when they were still mounted, and then we raided them when they were being mechanized. We used to sharpen them up. We were used as enemy, really, to sharpen other people up. We were fairly well trained by that time, and we did quite a lot. We used to go and do help the yeomanry training, yeomanry camps, that sort of thing.
By acting as the enemy, you'd actually literally attack them, would you? As a
well, yes, you. No, you don't attack. Well, I mean, you have umpires and you fire off flares and things like that. Yeah.
But what sort of? Hadn't you been trained out in Egypt mainly as a reconnaissance role?
Yeah, well, this is reconnaissance too. on roads this time. Roads. We had to stick to roads, you see, in Europe. Map reading. Map reading, I think, is probably half the battle.
Did you come across or come against infantry units as well?
Well, no, not much. I mean, no, he didn't train with them.
When you went to Aldershot, you know, you're part of the 1st Division there, were you?
No, we're still, we've always been sort of army troops, do you see? The armor car regiments, the only two armor car regiments in the army, the 11th and us, they're still army troops used for the army commander or corps commander, if anything for else, for reconnaissance and quick information, you see. So we really had a line, you see, the idea when it happened in France, you see, we had a real link at army headquarters. And so that the army commander would get information direct. Occasionally, I know during the battle in France, we occasionally were put under a divisional commander various times. But the rail link would move to whoever we were giving the information to.
And that was the sort of role you were training
for? Yes, that's the role we were training for in signals before the war and everything else. And of course, a tremendous lot of troop training. We did all sorts of little schemes where you put out little problems. It's hard to explain. But you put out problems with dummy guns or infantry and that sort of thing to test the troop leader and the car commander's reactions when coming under fire. We trained in that tremendously, troop training. And of course, all the other things. Cover from air, use of woods, camouflage. We knew bloody well that we'd have a German air superiority against us, which indeed we did have in France. We were pretty well trained over that to get under cover.
What about the night work? What kind of things were you doing at night then?
Oh, night would, again, you see, the great thing was to move a column at night without lights. And, of course, we weren't, you see, an armoured car is not, in Europe, is not a very suitable vehicle or suitable military tool to put out on picket at night, because it can be stalked in its size. So the general, as it happened in France, we were trained to be a screening the infantry in the advance, screening in advance, going forward, reconnaissance in advance. And as it happened in France, we were a rear guard by day while the infantry moved back. But at night, we couldn't be expected to cover any ground at night, you see, when you can't see. So that our night schemes were mostly moving at night, training chaps to drive without headlights and that sort of thing.
Do you have any crashes then?
No. No. No, we were fairly efficient.
At this time you were given Morris armoured cars.
Yes.
What did you think of
those? You've seen a picture of theirs, haven't you? Well, they were very fast and an extremely good wireless set, as I told you, the number 9. But it had a 3-man crew. No, it had a 4-man crew, but it had no turret and had no top to it. And very little armor, but it is a light reconnaissance machine. And the armament was negligible. It was a Bren gun and the bloodiest, silliest thing has ever been invented by ordnance, called a Boyce anti-tank rifle. A useless affair. The only time we used it was to shoot holes in the armoured cars before we threw them in the canal, before we went into left Dunkirk. And they're useless affair of boys. Afterwards we got far better, later on in the war, we got better armament in the armoured cars. But no, the Bren gun was just a sort of shoot. We did shoot a bit, frighten the Germans a bit, kill a few. But the boys' anti-tank was a damn silly thing. And it was an extremely fast, mobile machine that it did look a bit, well, it did look rather formidable because on the side they had two smoke discharges, which were great big, they looked like guns. And all they did was to discharge smoke. But they looked rather formidable, and I think that once did save my life in France because I advanced on a tank which I thought was French, and it turned out to be German, and it retreated. And the only reason it retreated behind a wall was because I think it was looking at these smoke discharges. As soon as I realized it was German, he turned around and was very glad that Morris could go very fast, because it, a tank could blow you out of the water very quickly.
Were you at the time sort of dissatisfied with the Morris? Did you feel it was inadequate?
No, we didn't think very much. I don't think we thought very much. I mean, in those days, we subalterns and squadron leaders, we took it. We took it. We didn't argue. We didn't left it to other people to do that. And I think the morale was good in that way. And if you just go around and start thinking of machine is bad, I think it's very bad for morale. I agree, grant you, if you've been in action after we were, when we came back from France, when I'd had a hell of a lot of chaps killed, and had a very fine man killed beside me with an armour-piercing bullet, I did feel that the Morris armoured car was no bloody good, or very inadequately armoured. But to start a campaign and think that you've got no faith in your tools would be madness. Absolute madness. And later on, I think you'll find that if you talk to some of the cavalry regiments, armored cavalry regiments, that the cruiser tank was supposed to be a wonderful thing. It was very fast. But when the cruiser tank came up against German armament, it proved to be inadequately armored. And they gave it up. And the later, I think the cruiser tank did away with a lot of damn good men in the 9th, 10th Queen's Bays, 1st Armored Brigade, 2nd Armored Brigade. So one didn't go into battle thinking that one's kit was bad. Found out afterwards.
Did you train at this time as interchangeable roles in the armoured car itself? I mean, could the man who drove fire?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes, they were all tradesmen, you see. But they had to, they did change over. They all changed over during the individual training. But the real top, a fellow who was a top-class radio operator would always be a radio operator, although he'd be trained to drive or shoot. They all were interchangeable in that way. But you'd find that the cobbler stuck to his last when he came to them. They're all interchangeable, but you had the best of them in the right jobs with replacements behind.
During this period, were you as a junior subaltern, were you aware of the sort of tank theorists like Hobart and people like that?
I don't think so. No, well, by that time I was second in command of the squadron. No, I don't think so. We reckon that. Well, I'll tell you if you really want to know, is that we reckon that the tank theorists were rather stationary-minded over ground and tactics. And we reckon that we, through generations of teaching, knew a great deal more about ground, practical tactical use of ground. And I still think we did, too. I don't think that there was anything else to it. We thought that we were quicker in the uptake, you want to say.
You mean reacting to things happening?
Yeah. And I think with few exceptions that it was proved in the war. The exception being Pip Roberts. That's all.
Had you heard of Hobart, in fact, in this time?
No. No, I hadn't heard about him. The first time we met him was after the 1941, when we after the British Army came back from Dunkirk, they formed these new regiments, of which I had to became second in command of the second line of the 12 Lancers, the 27th Lancers. And we then, all these new regiments, with virtually, well, they were completely untrained men. We had a cadre of NCOs. We had to train as the 11th Armoured Division, all untrained. We went up to Yorkshire. And taken over by Hubbard. And it was quite obvious that he had a pretty poor opinion of cavalrymen. And I'd heard that he was a bit of a tiger. And we won him completely over, as far as I'm concerned. We got on frightfully well with him. We were working flat out at the time, until shit scared of the Germans coming in and invading us, and doing about 3 weeks' work in one, and very well guided by Hobo. And we got on very well with him. He realized we were working bloody hard. He was helpful and good. And I was trying to remember, he had a first-class tank called first of all, his G1 was chap in the Greys, as a friend of mine, Maxson. But he was his G1 still.